body. So I think this has caused a bit of a change. And, you know, you beyond the point, you cannot hide the fact that there are bodies floating down a river, that there are thousands of bodies just piled up along the banks because people are so desperate and so distraught that they cannot even afford to light the fire to cremate them. All of this cannot be hidden beyond the point. So I think there's a little bit of a change. Nonetheless, mainstream media has still not pointed fingers where it should be pointed, which is at the central leadership. And again, that's because the climate of fear persists.
And the government, I understand, has made it more difficult for foreign entities or individuals to send money to India to help people. To support NGOs. What's that about?
Well, basically, the Modi government put in a whole range of very, very restrictive requirements on all those who receive foreign funds, all the non-governmental organizations, making it almost impossible to function. The rules are so restrictive that most organizations basically would have to either close shop or dramatically reduce their activities. And that's because these were the places where you could get some independent, you know, support and some independent thinking, or even, you know, grassroots movements demanding the rights of people, whether it is land rights or workers' rights or women's rights or whatever. Having done that, then of course, when it comes to the need for welfare, the government is refusing to provide welfare. It's telling the NGOs, now you provide welfare. But you have destroyed those NGOs. They don't have money, they don't have resources. So they are not able to do what is required, provide the relief, which the government should be providing and is not providing. So they tied their own hands, in a sense. They are unwilling to provide what is minimally required. And yet, at the same time, they will not let others do it. In this latest crisis in Delhi, when there was some who anyway individually went out and tried to help in whatever way, providing oxygen cylinders, looking for hospital beds, trying to get, they have been under attack. Police have registered cases against them. So it's extraordinary that, you know, one of the phrases that the Prime Minister used to great effect when he was a campaigner was, "Na khaunga, na khane dunga." I will not take bribes effectively. I will not eat, and I will not let others take bribes. I will not let others eat. That now people are saying, well, na karunga, na karne dunga. I will not do anything myself. I will not let others do anything either, which is a terrifying situation for a country to be, where your state is effectively not doing the minimal things that governments have to do. And yet it's not letting others, it's not letting civil society rise up to that challenge and do it either. It's an extraordinary dystopia that we're in at the moment.
That's Jyoti Ghosh on India's COVID catastrophe. This is Independent Alternative Radio. Stay tuned at the end to learn how you can get copies of this program and for our special book offer, Noam Chomsky's Consequences of Capitalism. Our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free printed transcript, MP3, or PDF of this program, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. It's reported that of India's 1.3 billion people, that about only 3% have been fully vaccinated. How is that possible in a country that is a major producer of vaccines? I believe two of its large organizations.
You know, there are several things that have been done to destroy what was a very robust system of production and distribution of vaccines. India is not just the largest producer of vaccines in the world. It was also, we had the best universal, you know, immunization system, a 70-year-old system where, you know, workers will go house to house to immunize against polio, to do the BCG vaccines for children and so on. We had a very good, effective, functioning system of free universal vaccination. The Modi government, first of all, did not do its basic math in terms of looking at the population, looking at the requirement of vaccines, and ensuring that there would be enough production. There is one homegrown vaccine which was produced with the Indian Council of Medical Research. It was licensed to only one producer, which is ridiculous. You could have licensed it to 10 producers. There are 8 public sector companies. There are many other drug companies willing to produce this vaccine. You could have licensed it to many producers to make sure there is enough to meet the needs of the population. You didn't do that. Only one favored producer. And of course, the Serum Institute of India, which has a deal with AstraZeneca and various others. But it's not possible for 2 companies alone to meet the needs, as you mentioned, of 1.3 billion or even of 70% of the population. You have to have more producers. The Indian government could have done the compulsory licensing for at least one of the vaccines, not the AstraZeneca one, but the other one, but it did not do that. It has now done that, which is going to take another 6 months before those vaccines are available for distribution. Having done that, it then assumed that it was going to only need a tiny amount of vaccines and it could actually export. So in addition to the requirements for COVAX, which the Serum Institute had already committed to, it exported a lot of vaccines commercially and some for free as a sort of goodwill gesture to some poor countries. This is without taking into account the needs of the local population. So there were many mistakes made at many different levels, not producing enough, not enabling vaccines that were produced locally to be distributed locally in the first instance to meet the requirements of the population. And then worst of all, 17th of April, they announced a whole new vaccination strategy. Instead of a government, central government procurement and distribution of vaccines to all the states according to their population, suddenly it was thrown open. The central government will only vaccinate frontline health workers and people above 65. Everybody else, the state governments have to deal with. And for the 18 to 45 age group, they can go to private providers who can compete for these vaccines from the same limited production. They can compete with state governments for these vaccines. It's unbelievable and it makes absolutely no sense in the middle of a pandemic to throw this open to price gouging by private pharma at a time. And so what, state governments were paying 4 times, 6 times what the central government pays, private producers, who knows what they're paying? And you know, to get the Covaxin, one dose of the Covaxin costs about $30, which is impossible in a poor country like India. So the absolute ludicrousness in, and complete, you know, completely wrong vaccination policy that was suddenly introduced on the 17th of April has thrown the whole system into complete, complete mess, because the rate of vaccination which was going up has now dramatically declined after this new policy was announced. Why? Because the companies are hoarding the vaccines, trying to sell to the highest bidder. State governments cannot buy it. Private companies are managing to buy some. Private clinics are buying some, quickly distributing it, not able to get the next lot. It's a complete mess. None of this was necessary. And it is unthinkable how or on whose advice the government did this extraordinary system, which has actually destroyed what was a very successful universal immunization program.
Talk about COVAX, another acronym. It's International Vaccine Sharing Scheme. Do you think it's a good thing? Is it, has it been effective?
The COVAX is a facility set up by the World Health Organization, by the Vaccine Alliance Gavi, and by the Council for Epidemiological Preparedness. So it's a joint program which will buy vaccines and distribute. So in a sense, the idea is good, which is that you pool together vaccine procurement rather than get all this competitive buying and so on. You pool it together and then you distribute it equitably. The idea was that you distribute first 3% of the population, then to 20% of the population, and then to everybody. There were 2 major design flaws in COVAX, and some people argue that that's because COVAX had too much disproportionate influence of pharma producers. One was that it is underfunded hugely. It would need a minimum of $26 to $30 billion in the first year. It's got only about, I think, 4.3 billion or something. It's ridiculous. It's very underfunded. But more importantly, COVAX did not prevent governments who are members from doing side deals. So what happened? that governments said, yes, yes, we'll join COVAX, but they also went and did side deals with private pharma. And so you had the rich countries doing, you know, deals for many times what their population needed. The US did, I think, 4 times what its population needed, the European Union 3 times, Canada up to 10, 11 times. It's a different matter that they were not able to get those vaccines, but the point is they had already grabbed these orders, which really meant developing countries didn't have a chance, and nor did COVAX, because these orders, the private deals, are opaque. We don't know how much who is paying for each one, but WHO estimates that the price can go up to $40, $44 per dose. So obviously vaccine companies are more interested in selling privately, separately to these countries than they are to, you know, giving to COVAX, as a result of which COVAX, even with its limited funds, has not been able to procure as much as it needs, even for its initial commitments. So everybody is blaming the Serum Institute of India for not fulfilling its COVAX commitments. And I think that's true and that's valid. But why are these other companies not even making COVAX commitments? Why don't you get after, you know, Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson for not even making COVAX commitments, instead selling privately to rich country governments?
Well, those big pharma corporations you just mentioned are making a killing on vaccines. Now, China and Russia have developed their own vaccines. What do you know about them, and have they been relatively successful?
Yes. In fact, China has exported more vaccines than any other country. There are 2 vaccines of China, Sinovac and Sinopharm, which are apparently quite effective. Sinopharm has very recently received WHO regulatory approval. I should mention that the WHO regulatory system privileges the vaccines produced in rich countries, because all the other producers have to go through a very complicated and prolonged bureaucratic procedure. So both the Gamaleya Institute's Sputnik V and Sinopharm, and also Sinovac, they all applied for regulatory approval before Pfizer and Moderna. But Pfizer and Moderna got their approval by late October. Sinopharm has just got its approval. The others still haven't. That has not stopped some countries who are in desperate need from asking for those vaccines anyway. So Chile's relative success in vaccination is really because of its reliance on Chinese vaccines. A bunch of other countries in the Middle East have also heavily relied on Chinese vaccines. These are cheaper. These, many cases in developing countries, they're being provided free. And instead of celebrating that, I think that's a good thing. I think we should be providing as much vaccine as possible to as many countries as possible. The same rich countries that are hoarding their own vaccines and are preventing other countries from accessing and are preventing their companies from sharing the technology are telling developing countries, don't use the Chinese and Russian vaccines. They're not to be trusted. They're not safe. I find that extraordinary.
The New York Times says India is experiencing, quote, the world's worst coronavirus outbreak. But there are also other hotspots that are just suddenly appearing. For example, in neighboring Nepal, also in Argentina has become a hotspot. How do you see this pandemic being contained and coming at least manageable to some extent?
So you see, this is the point that it's a cliche now, because all these world leaders keep mouthing it, like world peace. They say, no one is safe till everyone is safe. Unfortunately, they don't seem to believe their own words, but they are true. That is the situation. That is the nature of a pandemic. Today, it's India, and as you mentioned, Nepal, and it's also spreading in Bangladesh. It's also spreading in Southeast Asia, which had controlled it completely. We are seeing new variants emerge in Latin America. Africa is going to be a very likely new hotspot. And these are all parts of the world that are hardly vaccinated, where there's a very tiny minority that has received vaccination. The more you allow this to happen, the more you will get new variants, and the more those variants can come back and even threaten the vaccinated populations. I don't understand why the world leaders who keep saying this don't seem to get it and do something in terms of their own policy, because what can be done is so obvious and easy. It's low-hanging fruit. force the companies who have received your technology, your financial support, to share that knowledge with other producers. There are producers in Canada, in Israel, in the Philippines, in Bangladesh, in Chile, in Brazil, who are willing to make it. Force them to share this technology. Force much enhanced production. Distribute your surplus vaccines. The United States is sitting on 60 million AstraZeneca doses it will never use. Immediately distribute. Give it to COVAX. Give it to countries that need it. I think it's all obvious that what needs to be done. Yet the same global leaders who keep saying this in all of their statements and communiques, obviously they're just saying this as a completely meaningless statement. They don't actually understand what they're saying. If they understood it, they would take these measures which are so obvious and so evident. Suspend intellectual property during the pandemic, because that's the only way you will actually deal with the pandemic. It's a minimum necessary condition for all the other stuff.
The tiny minority vaccinated that you mentioned is, of course, concentrated in the global north exclusively. Backtrack a little bit to the Russian vaccine, the Sputnik. How effective has that proven to be?
So the evidence we have so far is that it's quite effective. I think it's, 75% effective? I'm not sure about the exact numbers, but recent studies that have come out in The Lancet and in Science have suggested that it is really quite effective. It has yet to receive WHO regulatory approval, unfortunately, but nonetheless, it is being used in a number of countries, and it has expanded. It's actually gone into production sharing agreements in several developing countries. So we'll have to see. But at this point, I would say the WHO should certainly up its game in terms of the regulatory processes, which are very prolonged for vaccines from certain countries. And the rich countries, I mean, it's on their plate. The G7 have to put their actions where their mouth has been for the last 1 year.
President Biden recently announced an additional 20 million doses to be given to what countries that was not specified. But one critic has called this trying to put a bucket of water on a raging fire.
Yes, but it's not just that. It's also that you have maybe, 100 buckets of water and you're giving one. I think it's a little obscene that the US government is sitting on all these surplus stockpiles of vaccine. 60 million AstraZeneca, God knows how many Pfizer and Moderna. You're stockpiling them, you're hoarding vaccines, and then you're giving a little small share of that to some. I mean, I don't understand it. I really don't. I think history will judge this very harshly.
The Russian and the Chinese vaccines, are they privately controlled or are these government based?
The Chinese companies are publicly owned companies. So they're both produced, I think, by one public sector company. And there's another one that is also developing another two vaccine candidates. Gamaleya Institute, it's a little more complicated. I think it's done with the assistance of private venture capital, but with also state support. But we have to remember that even the private companies in the advanced countries all received massive government support. AstraZeneca is a striking example of a vaccine that was produced in a lab that is publicly funded and run through charities, okay, in Oxford University. The original intent of this Oxford vaccine was that it would be completely publicly available. They were going to put everything on the website for everyone to access. Midway through the process in June 2020, the Gates Foundation, which is a big funder of Oxford University, stepped in and ensured that this became a private deal between Oxford and AstraZeneca, which had had no role in the development of the vaccine. Let me reiterate, no role. So all the stuff that Big Pharma tells us, that we only have these vaccines because Big Pharma has done all this investment in R&D, this is nonsense. And so it became the intellectual property of AstraZeneca through this unfortunate side deal that was done by Oxford University for something that was developed in a public research lab. Similarly, we know that the Pfizer vaccine was not developed by Pfizer. It was developed by BioNTech, which got a lot of money from the German government, which basically funded its R&D costs. And it was then a private deal entered into between BioNTech and Pfizer, which has enabled Pfizer to make, I think, an estimated $24 billion in profits in this current year, way in excess of its total R&D costs, all costs. Pfizer's own estimation is $4 billion. So we are talking about monopoly super profits being made on the basis of knowledge that was done through public research and public funding. Remember also that both the mRNA vaccines and Moderna, it's got $1.6 billion from the US government. It promised not to profit from any of these vaccines. We don't know how that is working out because it's charging different prices to different buyers. But the mRNA technology was essentially developed by a Hungarian scientist in a public lab and then developed further in US public labs. So it's the last mile effort that was done by these companies using public support. So let's not kid ourselves that this was all private companies doing this and that the government is coming in late on this. This was really the public sector completely enabling and funding the development of these vaccines. Yet all the cards are currently being held by these private companies.
It's interesting because, as you well know, in the United States, there's been massive state, that is to say, public intervention in the economy, which is supposed to be, quote unquote, a free market system. It's hardly free market when you have billions of dollars in research and development funded by taxpayers, leading to the internet, GPS technology, polio vaccines, subsidies to fossil fuel corporations, and the like. So it's a peculiar type of capitalism that has elements of, can we call it socialism?
So my colleague Bob Polin says that this is champagne socialism for the rich and predatory capitalism for the poor. But it's really, that's what neoliberalism is all about. As I said, it is not about the withdrawal of the state. It's not about leaving markets on their own. It's all about protecting big capital, protecting, supporting, incentivizing, and rewarding big capital. That's what neoliberalism is about.
But that intervention is very selective.
It's for big capital. So when finance is in a crisis, you save the big banks, you bail them out, you use taxpayer money to save them. You don't bail out the small mortgagees. You don't bail out the people who lose their homes. You don't bail out workers.
Bill Gates has, of course, made quite a name for himself and a bit of money on the side. He has spoken very forcefully against waiving of patents. He thinks that would be a very bad idea. What is Gates's role in this whole situation?
The little that I have seen of the Bill Gates intervention in health, I think there are many, many serious concerns. He was instrumental, as I mentioned, in the move to shift Oxford University to a separate deal with AstraZeneca. He has been a forceful proponent of intellectual property at the time when he also has major investments in drug companies. How such serious conflicts of interest can be tolerated, accepted, and taken for granted is something that boggles the mind. That people who are so influential in a public health discourse have direct commercial interests through their shareholding and other things in the companies that would benefit from that. Surely this would not be allowed in many systems, and yet we are in this peculiar world where this is accepted as something normal.
We've talked about equity and distribution. Top White House advisor Anthony Fauci said, the only way that you're going to adequately respond to a global pandemic is by having a global response. And a global response means equity throughout the world. So there's at least one scientist who understands the nature of the crisis and the absolute necessity to have vaccine equity. There's no safe place if we don't have it.
You know, Dr. Fauci has said this, and it's very important and it's very good. But you know, all these leaders say this, G7 communiques say this all the time. When it comes to action and what you can do about it, somehow that is lacking. And I think that is extremely unfortunate.
The Guardian Weekly recently wrote, as vaccine programs enable rich societies to open, the poorer nations are bearing the brunt. What about what's happening in the global south? Of the 700 million vaccines distributed, only 0.2% have gone to what are called low-income countries. And the WHO reports 46 million asylum seekers, migrants, and refugees have been totally excluded from vaccination programs.
You know, vaccine apartheid is so striking globally and in this way that we've mentioned, that it's also now, I mean, you know, it's almost interesting to see how this is now playing out into the next phase, which was almost inevitable, the vaccine passports. The European Union has just announced that fully vaccinated people with the acceptable vaccines, please note, not the Chinese vaccine, not, you know, any other vaccine, but the accepted vaccines, those vaccinated persons are free to come. So you're really getting this peculiar reversal back to the colonial period where the white men could roam the world as they pleased and everybody else, their movements were either restricted or constrained or determined by those white men. So we're back to a very colonial world, which has been actively supported by the capital of its time, just as the colonialism of that time was supported by capital of that time.
Your Dollars and Cents article was in fact entitled Neoliberalism as Neo-Colonialism.
And now we see it openly. Now there's no pretense about it anymore.
You know, I'm reminded of Kurtz's dying words in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, the horror, the horror.
Yes.
Well, neocolonialism also has led to, well, according to Prabhat Patnaik, who has also been featured on alternative radio, he said that this neoliberalism has also led to neo-fascism around the world, where governments have veered far to the right. Do you see a connection between those two?
I think it's very hard for neoliberalism to persist with democracy. We see that all over the world. I think in the United States, you dodged a bullet. You still have a lot of threats to your democracy. But it's also interesting to note that because you managed to dodge that bullet, there are various ways in which within your own country, you're trying to undo some of the worst effects of neoliberalism. But everywhere else, it's really not compatible with democracy. I think we've seen that over and over again.
Some months ago, you wrote, I'm quoting, "Is the current apparently passive fatalistic attitude of the oppressed millions the sign of a new subjugation or simply a lull before the storm?"
I don't really pretend to understand politics anymore. I think I used to have a much more materialist conception of politics, and I recognize now that all kinds of other things can sway people, whether it is notions of social justice or it is identities of various kinds, or it's just hate can sway people and how they vote and who they support and so on. However, I also do have a fundamental belief that humanity steps back from the brink. And let's admit it, we are at the brink. We are at a brink. The pandemic has brought us to a brink, but we also face a much greater existential challenge in the form of climate change, which is going to get worse and worse. And it's really a question of survival. If humanity is to survive, it will have to step back. And that really means the people themselves have to shake off all of these other things and focus on the things that will enable humanity to survive. If that is the case, then I do believe that things can change. And I also believe that change often comes from directions where you don't expect it. So we may be looking at, I don't know, the opposition in a particular country and say, oh, that opposition hasn't got its act together. It's not unified. It's all over the place. It doesn't command the respect of the people. So it's not going to succeed. Maybe the change will come from a different direction. And this has been the case in the past. That's why I'm saying it. So I do believe change will come. I hope I'm alive to see it. I also believe that humanity will step back from the brink.
What can individuals who are listening to you and your analysis of the current crisis, what can they do and what can be done collectively?
Ultimately, all change happens collectively. It doesn't happen through individuals. So I think the first thing individuals have to note is that they are not little islands and Robinson Crusoes who can make things happen on their own. So a lot, I find a lot of the progressive energy here goes into how you live your own life. You know, whether you are, shall we say, ecologically correct and politically correct in your own life. I think that's good and that's important, but it doesn't do much in terms of broader social change. So I think the importance of the collective, of collective action, of working with other people, of forming coalitions, of being part of progressive movements, of recognizing the importance of numbers and seeking to expand those numbers, I think that's very important. And wherever there has been progressive change, it's come from people who recognize that.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, David.
That was Jyoti Ghosh on India's COVID catastrophe. I talked with her on May 19th. Jyoti Ghosh is a renowned economist and award-winning author. She taught at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi for almost 35 years. She currently teaches at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 35th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Jyoti Ghosh on India's COVID catastrophe, and for Noam Chomsky's book, Consequences of Capitalism, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go on our website, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of a printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the thing about the U.S. Postal Service, low-income people get the same service as the rich. Rural people get their prescriptions and paychecks and ballots in the same time frame as those in big cities. The idea has always been that postal service is a public good, not to be mined for profit and not tiered to give the wealthy yet another leg up. USPS is the second largest employer in the country, traditionally offering opportunities for people of color. And unlike the number one employer, Walmart, it doesn't subsidize itself by paying wages so low that employees have to also rely on public assistance. That's why it's so worrying that the current leaders of the Postal Service seem intent on driving it into the ground. We'll talk about the fight for the post office with Lisa Graves, executive director and editor-in-chief at True North Research. Also on the show, Attorney General Merrick Garland has ordered the FBI to work with local leaders to help address the, quote, disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence, close quote, against educators and school board members over mask mandates and also interpretations of critical race theory, which has been distorted by conservative operatives to mean any teaching about racism or systemic inequity in U.S. society. If you didn't know that K-12 teachers and college professors are under actual attack simply for teaching the unvarnished truth of U.S. history, it might be because somehow many free speech advocates, including in the press corps, haven't taken on this disturbing encroachment on the rights of educators and students. Teachers, however, are fighting back, and a number of groups are planning a day of action on October 14th to shed light on that fight and what's at stake. We'll hear about that from Stevana Sims, public school counselor in Montclair, New Jersey, and a member of the steering committee of the group Black Lives Matter at School. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When anti-government zealots take control of government agencies, they generally talk about efficiency and how government should run more like a business. The U.S. Postal Service is not McDonald's. It's critical infrastructure, so critical that it's mentioned in the Constitution. But also, what business would trumpet a plan to make its service slower and more expensive? That's just what the plan announced by Donald Trump donor and appointee Louis DeJoy looks set to do for what analysts say would be negligible savings. The first postmaster general in decades with no postal experience, DeJoy clearly has something else in mind other than shoring up the USPS, the most popular government agency and the country's second largest employer after Walmart. Unless, that is, he is stopped. Here to talk about what's going on and what might be done about it is Lisa Graves, Executive Director and Editor-in-Chief at True North Research. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Lisa Graves.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be back. And thank you so much for that beautiful and concise introduction about the challenges we're facing. That was so well put. Thank you so much.
Well, here's where we're at. You know, I mean, the LA Times' Michael Hiltzik wrote a column headed, "Remember Louis DeJoy? He's still in charge of the Postal Service, but why?" Unfortunately, he wrote that in February, and here we still are, talking about slower deliveries, higher prices, closing branches, cutting hours. I called it the slowest daylight robbery ever, and it's still going forward, right?
Well, that's right, and you know, the price increases have already started to go into effect for first-class mail, and more price increases for packages just in time for this holiday season. And so here you have a guy, as you pointed out, who was put into place in part by Trump. He's a Trump donor, and Trump named all the people to the board that approved his hiring to jump to the head of the line. And he has no experience running the Postal Service or within the Postal Service. And he is embarking on one of the most outlandish plans ever unveiled, which is to charge Americans more for slower mail. As you said, it's just not running it like a business, if that were even something a business would do. It's really a path toward the decline of the Postal Service to basically, I think, in my view, to make it so that the Postal Service, it paves the way for it to be privatized by declining the usage of the Postal Service by real people and by catering to businesses.
Well, these people kind of telegraph their moves, you know, hobble and hollow out an agency, then say it's inefficient and should be privatized. They don't really leave a lot of mystery, you know. They just don't believe in government delivering public goods to the whole public. You explained, and folks should look up the transcript when we spoke in July of last year, you talked about how this is a decades-long effort involving some familiar folks like Charles Koch behind it. But one name that we might not know is that of Ron Blum, who is right now chair of the USPS Board of Governors. What should we know about him?
He is someone who was appointed to that role by Donald Trump. He has worked for private equity firms, and he currently works for a private equity firm. He's basically a partner, a leader of a firm whose CEO has extolled privatization of public assets in the U.S. and abroad. And so his day job, the job that really pays his salary, Ron Blum's salary, is a private equity firm called Brookfield Asset Management. And he previously worked for another private equity firm called Lazard that was involved in privatizing the United Kingdom's postal service, the Royal Mail, a few years back and profiting handsomely from it. Blum says that he won't profit from any, you know, privatization or deals with the Postal Service, but if he helps DeJoy basically destroy the Postal Service through these super unwise changes in cutting back air mail and lowering our mail and charging us more than the postal service we picked over by vultures, like these sorts of private equity firms.
Well, and not for nothing, but there's a relationship between DeJoy and Bloom.
Yes. You know, one of the things that was surprising in the Washington Post documented this about a month or so ago was that Bloom's firm is investing in the firm that was previously owned by DeJoy. And DeJoy's firm, that's called XPO, had just received an enormous outsourcing contract for logistics operations for the U.S. mail earlier this year, and he was buying bonds from Bloom's firm. And so I think that's very troubling. Mm-hmm. The idea also that DeJoy said that he wasn't involved in the decision to outsource that operation to XPO, you know, I don't personally think that it should even be allowed to have the impression
right.
of him profiting, because we also know, and I helped document, that he's receiving millions of dollars in revenue from XPO for the leasing of other logistical building for them.
It's just the kind of relationship that, you know, folks will say, oh, but it's not strictly speaking illegal. And you think, okay, but is it not a conflict?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
let me just say one thing. Is it true that amongst the many horrible and unstrategic things that DeJoy's 10-year strategic plan aims at, one of them is actually getting rid of that weird 2006 mandate that the Postal Service pre-fund their retiree health benefits, which we know is this manufactured crisis that allows folks to say that the Postal Service is inefficient or struggling, but it's because they have this weird fiscal thing they have to do. Is it true that we might be seeing the end of that?
It's true that that plan, along with, you know, a bipartisan effort that's been pushed for quite a while, includes getting rid of that burden, which was really spurred by the Koch right-hand guy who was formerly the chair of the Postal Service. And so that has hampered the Postal Service's ability to invest and to get loans and more to modernize its operations. And so he has embraced the repeal of that provision. And meanwhile, he's embarked on this effort to, you know, basically, in my view, start to privatize the Postal Service and diminish the service that people get and close rural post offices as well as some in cities to sell off some of those assets. And so we're still in danger, and mm-hmm. Congress has not yet passed that repeal, but I sure hope it does personally. I do.
Well, and yeah, with everything else going through, that might not be enough. And again, I would refer folks back to your July 2020 interview in which you explained how that requirement, that mandate was really set up to make the Postal Service more attractive to privatization. Well, let's move on now to the question, which is, how do we get rid of this guy? You know, how do we change things? Now, I've read that it's not up to Biden. It's really up to the 9-member Board of Governors, but that Biden can appoint some new ones. Some of them are holdovers. Right now, there's a 6-3 dominance of Trump appointees. But what are the steps necessary? So many people are unhappy with the direction DeJoy has taken. What would be the steps necessary to actually get him out of there?
Well, there are some people who think that President Biden could fire DeJoy as an agency head. It was a position that used to be a cabinet position, but there are others who contend that that should not happen because it's so-called independent agency, although it's one that has now been captured by a very partisan political operative who hails from the private sector and is, I think, moving the Postal Service toward the private sector. But what really can happen and should happen is that people should be contacting President Biden and urging him not to allow Bloom to stay on the board, not to allow another investment banker that Trump put on there, John Barger, to stay on the board, but to replace them. So to nominate two more people to the board who would put the people's interests first and who would counter and remove DeJoy.
Well, finally, struggling to keep USPS from being sabotaged is depressing on many levels, but it also hinders us in developing a positive vision of what a 21st century postal service could look like.
That's right. And, you know, the fact is that there are a lot of great ideas out there about how the Postal Service could be fully engaged in banking, which is a service that it previously provided in generations past in underbanked communities, and it can be a hub for internet access for that sort of infrastructure for communities. It can be a charging station as well for electric cars. It could provide other things to make post offices attractive, like coffee, when people go to send packages and get the mail. There's a lot of things the Postal Service could do to really be present in the 21st century in people's communities in even broader ways to help. And it's also the case that I think the Postal Service ought to be investing in planes. The idea that in the 21st century, our Postal Service is not going to be expanding its use of planes to get mail faster is absurd. The competitors of the Postal Service are expanding their fleets of planes because they know people want things as quickly as they possibly can for a good price.
And so you can't just set up the USPS to fail against FedEx and other places and then wonder why they're not thriving in the way that they could be.
Exactly. And there's so much the Postal Service could do. But again, that provision back in 2006 that hampered the Postal Service with this ridiculous accounting process that no other agency and no other business has for potential future liabilities, that process also forbade the Postal Service from engaging in any activities that would be so-called competitive with the private sector, including banking, which is really doing the service of the financial industry, the banking industry, and not the service of the ordinary American who could benefit from low-cost transactions at their local Postal Service branch.
Well, it just seems worth saying again, there's a reason that the USPS is in the Constitution, and it has to do with the fact that even if you live out in a rural area, even if you are poor, even if you live in the inner city, everybody gets the same treatment from the Postal Service. You know, that's the organizing concept behind it, is that it's not like if you have more money, you get better service. So it's a value also that we're trying to support.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it is the case that the Postal Service is in communities across the nation. It is not just the second largest workforce in the U.S., it's the most diverse workforce in the U.S. and provides so many opportunities for people of all walks of life, all color, all ethnicities to succeed and to have the things that people need in their life, to build families and build homes and build communities. And so if the Postal Service is allowed to fail, it doesn't just fail for America in general. It also would have a terrible impact on communities of color in the United States. And also, I just think this idea of the Postal Service refusing, other than a teeny tiny experiment, to engage and embrace postal banking is another way in which it could be deployed to really serve the interests of our communities, including communities of color. And it has not been, has been blocked from doing so for the most part.
Well, the fight is ongoing, and I'd like to thank you very much for joining us this week. We've been speaking with Lisa Graves of True North Research. Find their work online at truenorthresearch.org. Lisa Graves, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a joy to hear your voice and be on your show.
Biden rescinded the Trump executive order that threatened efforts to address racial disparities in the workplace under the implausible guise of combating anti-American race and sex stereotyping. But just because the push to stop people from talking or learning about racism, sexism, heterosexism, or this country's history of oppression has moved off the front page does not mean that it's gone away. Legislators in some 27 states are trying to require teachers to avoid what are termed divisive concepts in classrooms and curricula, an extremely thinly veiled effort to force teachers to propagandize about U.S. history rather than teach it and to punish those that don't toe the line. It's deeply disturbing, but it turns out teachers don't take kindly to being told to underserve their students by distorting historical and present reality. A major campaign is underway to push back and reassert the importance of critical education and the professional judgment of educators. We're joined now by Stevanna Sims. She is a member of Black Lives Matter at School Steering Committee and a school counselor in Montclair, New Jersey Public Schools. Welcome to Counterspin, Stevanna Sims.
Oh, thank you so much. I am so happy to be here.
Well, the American Association of University Professors, the American Historical Association, PEN America, a number of really mainstream respected organizations are sounding the alarm that these bills around the country are an infringement on the right of faculty to teach and students to learn. And yet here we are. So I just wanted to ask you first, what is this looking like and feeling like for the K-12 teachers that you interact with? How is this all affecting them day to day?
It is a direct attack on our K-12 teachers. It is to the point where teachers are getting fired and losing pay. It is to the point where there was a teacher who had a Black Lives Matter flag in her classroom and was asked to take it down. And because she refused, she was then removed from her position. There was a principal in Texas who was also accused of teaching critical race theory within his school, and he was removed from his job. It's coming to a point where threats, violent threats, are being made against teachers and educators who were teaching the truth and teaching education. It is scary, honestly, but it is necessary for what we are going to talk about really soon.
Absolutely. I think folks should know that it doesn't, even if you are not in a county or a region where there's actually a bill moving through, it still has that chilling effect.
Absolutely. Before this bill was even passed, to think about the teachers, the Black teachers that even I had in my school system that were pushed out because they were teaching critical race theory within a classroom and exposing systemic racism to juniors in high school and telling them to use their voice and empowering students. And so even before this bill has been passed, there has still been attacks on teachers teaching critical race theory and using a critical race lens within their classrooms. So the saga continues, unfortunately. And this is showing how important critical race theory is, because if it wasn't that important, they wouldn't be trying to silence it.
Absolutely. And we should note, and listeners probably know, that the proponents of this campaign, this gagging campaign, they don't know what critical race theory is.
Exactly.
It's jargon to them. Christopher Rufo, the architect of the campaign, said, quote, "The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory," close quotes. They're just throwing out there that the school systems that they're going after may never have said the words critical race theory. It's just about teaching about inequity.
Right.
Well, that's why Black Lives Matter at School and African American Policy Forum, where I'm on the board, that's what this whole Teach Truth, Truth Be Told, these campaigns are about. So I just want to ask you, what are you all up to this month, and what are the goals of these actions?
We are working. My. All the people that have been coming to these working group meetings, we're working. So with that being said, there are spaces where organizations can endorse the day of action for October 14th. Mm-hmm. There are spaces where they can share on social media. They can amplify what we are trying to do. And just imagine what social media would look like if all you see is teach truth, teach truth, truth be told, and all these hashtags. Just imagine the reverberation that is going to be. So we have to amplify. We have to share the message. We have to let people know that on October 14th, we are all mobilizing to teach the truth in our classrooms, in our conversations, in our schools. If teachers are unsure where to start, because we are all in different places in our activism,
right,
and in our movement. And so we have to reach those fence sitters. We have to reach those who want to do something but are not sure where to start. And so we have curriculum. Black Lives Matter at School has been working on curriculum because it fits within our year of purpose. But within that, you can go on blacklivesmatteratschool.com and you can find the curriculum. So not only do we have curriculum for this year's year of purpose, but we also have archived curriculum as well that teachers can have access to. You can also plan a virtual field trip for your students. As we know, COVID is still a real thing, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so there are virtual field trips that you can plan. ZenEducationProject.org is ZenEDProject.org. We'll have access to virtual field trips as well as Black Lives Matter at School. And then wear your T-shirt. Put your message across your chest. Teach truth. And even if you don't feel comfortable, and I'm speaking to those who may be under attack under this bill and those who may not feel comfortable necessarily teaching, you can still wear your T-shirt in solidarity with us. saying that we are going to teach the truth.
October 14th is a day of action, and that is a focus, but this is a much bigger project.
Yes.
When you talk about that year of purpose, what are you talking about?
The reason why October 14th is so significant is because it is the birthday of George Floyd. And so Black Lives Matter at School uses the birthday of George Floyd to launch the year of purpose. So what that is that we have 13 guiding principles that can also be found on our website. We know that a one hit is not going to change anything. There has to be this constant push against this critical race theory bill. And Zen Education Project as well does have resources, but Black Lives Matter at School curriculum is on the website that can be used to guide your year of purpose in teaching the truth.
It seems like such classic backlash politics because we have social movements and just a general recognition of the continued existence of racism and of inequity. They haven't disappeared. We're not a shining city on a hill.
Right.
And just the idea that we have to stop talking about that and that will somehow make it untrue. It's so regressive. And that's why I'm concerned that, you know, I'm not sure where I'm hearing the free speech folks. You know, it just feels like teachers are on the front line and leading the charge here, you know, which is terrific. But I mean, we need some allies and support.
It's very true. And it's funny that you say that. I just left the working group meeting. America is a very much anti-history place.
Right.
When we talk about slavery and we talk about indigenous people being taken off their land and their land being stolen, and it's like, oh, you need to forget that. That happened so many years ago. When we move in this anti-historical space of America, it really stunts us to kind of warp what's actually happening now, because as we know, history already affected the future in which we live in right now.
And I'm just thinking about students. Haven't we got beyond the empty vessel idea of teaching, you know, that students come in just empty and then teachers fill them up with stuff? Students are coming into school. They know their experience. They know their life. So when you have a Mexican-American, a Somali-American, African-American, to tell them your people did nothing and are nothing, that's just a crime, it seems like to me.
Absolutely. And just imagine how dehumanizing that is and why sometimes our kids of color disconnect from education because of the messages that are being sent.
Folks may be getting tangled up thinking it's about critical race theory and they don't really know what that is, or it's somehow about special lesson plans. But it's also in a fundamental way about power and about who gets to decide what educators do in their classroom. I'm not sure people understand quite how radical this move is to tell teachers what they can and cannot teach.
Actually, it infringes on academic freedom. It infringes on, like you said earlier, freedom of speech. But what I think is beneficial, though, for our K-12 teachers is that the National Education Association has endorsed the Day of Action of Teach Truth, which is huge, because our unions are our biggest advocate at times. And so to have the National Education Association endorse the Day of Action is huge. And with that, alongside AAPF, they will be doing a Know Your Right session. And the AAPF Teach Truth celebration will be at 3 p.m. on October 14th. And the NEA will be doing a Know Your Right for K-12 educators.
And that's something that everyone can get involved in. You don't have to be a teacher.
Absolutely.
And it affects all of us all the time in terms of what we're able to talk about. Well, let me just ask you, the feeling, though, is, I mean, I can imagine teachers feel frightened and disturbed and threatened, but I also hear a lot of energy and a lot of positive.
Yes.
We know what we're about here.
Absolutely. And it's uplifting for sure. And so it's just about finding those spaces. So once again, the resources, blacklivesmatteratschool.com, zenedproject.org, making sure that you join us on the Day of Action on October 14th.
All right. Well, onward.
Onward and upward.
We've been speaking with Stevanna Sims. We will keep our eyes on this story. Thank you so much, Stevanna Sims, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
I want to get back to being in my community group.
I want to continue having a soccer season.
So I can throw parties again.
So I can go to her parties.
It'd really be nice to dine in instead of getting delivery for a change.
So I can feel safe and protected for myself and my students.
We each have our own reason for why we're getting vaccinated against COVID-19. What will yours be? Visit getvaccineanswers.org for information on the COVID-19 vaccines. It's up to you. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Well, would you look at the time? Yeah, it happens at this time each and every week, halfway through the Viva Lamont radio program. Yeah, halfway. Which half? Just, it doesn't matter. I'm halfway through the program. And at this point, we do a WRCT radio and a WRCT music calendar, let you know some things going on around town. Things are opening up because, you know what, the cool kids are getting that vaccine in their arm, which is allowing everyone to go out and engage and, you know, do things and be safer and not kill my parents. So I appreciate that. I do. Before I get to the music and the radio calendar, let me remind you that Row House Cinema joins you in supporting WRCT. Now, Row House Cinema is a single-screen theater in the historic Lawrenceville neighborhood of Pittsburgh, and each week they choose a new movie theme to show classic, cult, foreign, animated, fun, and fascinating films in a magical setting. Keep in mind with the pandemic restrictions and lifts and non-restrictions and all that, if you go to their website, rowhousecinema.com, you can see how Row House Cinema is doing their best to be a good steward to the neighborhood and the community while keeping the film arts alive in Pittsburgh. They're located at 4115 Butler Street in Lawrenceville. For more information, rowhousecinema.com, or you can call them up at 412-904-3225. And don't forget, if you are interested or you work for someone or you own a business and you are interested in underwriting WRCT or underwriting the Viva Lamont radio program, think of that. How cool would that be? You can send an email to pr@wrct.org. Find out more about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Let's turn our attention to that calendar I mentioned. The WRCT radio calendar lets you know some things going on. It kicked off last weekend. It's going through the 13th. So there's a chance if you're listening to this program and it's past the 13th, you missed it. But I'm talking about the annual Dollar Bank Three Rivers Arts Festival. It's both in-person and it's virtual. There's an artist market that features 50 independent artists in an open-air setting, selling handmade arts and crafts each and every day of the festival. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the festival has music at the Dollar Bank main stage. Since the music is happening, I believe, at the Byam Theater, what they're doing is they're streaming this through their social channels so that you can listen and watch it, and you don't have to actually be there. You don't have to show up and be in person if that's not your thing and still experience these free shows. So more information at craf.trustarts.org. Also, once again, depending on when you're listening to this, but the weekend of June 11th through the 13th, Steel City Con is coming back. It is the largest Comic-Con in Pittsburgh. It's one of the largest ones in the United States. You can meet TV and film celebrities, as well as see, like, celebrity Q&As and panels and all that. There's celebrity photo ops. Did you hear me say the word celebrity a lot? Yeah, it happens there. What celebrities? People like this year, like The Shat. William Shatner's there. Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. Many, many more. It's at the Monroeville Convention Center all weekend long. More information at steelcitycon.com. And if you like movies, think of this. The Cary Blast Furnaces in Rankin are hosting a drive-in where the blast furnace is basically your backdrop. That's the word I'm looking for. I don't know what your drop box is, but that's not what they have. They've got double features all summer long. For more information, go to riversofsteel.com/experiences and check that out. Also, now through the end of November, Grace Jones. There's an exhibition at the Warhol called A Taste of Grace, all about this groundbreaking musician, model, actress, and performer. Yeah, Jones met Warhol back in the 70s. They remained lifelong friends until his passing. The exhibit features highlights of Jones as a cultural sensation and includes portraits by Warhol and over 30 photographs and dozens of archival items. More information about the exhibits at warhol.org. And finally, I'm going to tell you about the Lawrenceville Farmers Mart because it happens each and every Tuesday from 3 to 7 at Arsenal Park in Lawrenceville. Rain or shine, it does happen, so dress appropriately.
And welcome to the Gray Area on WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Leia Minsky, and tonight I will be playing a disco funk set heavily inspired by Numero Group and all the amazing artists I have discovered through them. So I hope you enjoy. Up first, we have Touch Me Too by Budgie and Glued to the Spot by Cheryl Glasgow.
Kiss me.